Good morning, and welcome to Ag in Uncertain Times, our webinar series. I'm John Newkirk. I'm the director of the Washington State University Western Center for Risk Management Education. This webinar series is put together. I'm not going to introduce all of the members, but they're from someone from each of the universities that you see represented here. And in addition, we've had a great deal of help from a number of other individuals, including our presenters and others that are providing advice. Our webinar series is designed to provide information, hopefully that's very useful in helping producers and others meet the challenge of today's uncertain economy. And this morning we start our September series, Operating in the Face of Uncertain Markets. And kind of the paradigm, that's not exactly the correct word, but anyway, you get the idea, is the session this morning is kind of talking about where are we. It's kind of setting the context for our September series, which is built around markets. We have two presenters. There will be an opportunity for questions after each presentation. We'd like you to enter those in this chat box that you see over here at the left. And at the end, we'll have a bit of a three-person panel, myself and the two presenters, a chance for question and answers. I'll introduce these individuals more in a minute, but with us this morning is Matt Roberts from Ohio State University, and Jim Robb from the Livestock Marketing Information Center. If you have questions for them as their presentation goes along, we'd like you to enter those in this chat window that you see just to the left here. You type your question in the small narrow window at the bottom, and then you click on the little return arrow that shows up just to the right of that, at which point we have our team operating behind the scenes here. We'll take those questions. If we have several similar ones, they'll roll them into one. They'll post them, and then I will give them to the presenters. We had a really good series, and I'm not, of course, as part of the planning team, you would expect me to say that, but we had a lot of extremely positive feedback. Back in June around credit issues and ag credit, all of those presentations are up on our web page. We'll present this web link later. It was also in the notice that we sent out on this in this meeting. But those webinar series, the actual recordings of the webinar are there, and for most of the presenters, their slide presentations are there as well. Next in our marketing series in September, next Wednesday, we've got two additional excellent presenters, one talking about Ed Essett, talking about grain marketing strategies, Dylan Foyts talking about livestock marketing strategies. The following day on September 17th is non-commodities type of marketing strategies, looking at niche, specialty crop, and alternative marketing strategies. On the 23rd of September, how do we get there? A couple, again, we've been really pleased by the response of the individuals we've reached out to and their willingness to step up and present. We have two other very good presenters on the 23rd of September talking about tools. Don Thillamy talking more about direct markets, niche markets, alternative markets. Raleigh Curtis talking more about commodity market. Another resource in which information is posted, in which our information is also posted there, is the eExtension website called MITnet, eExtension.org. And there is a whole list of resources there for farm and ranch families that you can access as well. If you want to see this morning's presentations in full screen, you'll see on your screen a button. It's a toggle button that takes you to full screen like this. And so if you're having trouble seeing the slides or whatever, you can go to the full screen button. At this point, we've got some questions we'd like you to respond to. And we'll do this two other times during this morning's program between our speakers and then at the end. And the questions, and if Trent, you can pull that polling pod on there, help us in our planning and understanding who our audience is. It's really very simple. Just go on to and click on the little dot to the left of A, B, C, or D, or whatever is the appropriate one there. If you can do that quickly, we really would encourage you all to do this, even if you've been with us before and done this. It gives us some of these give us a profile, our audience. It has helped us to understand that we've had a national audience. We've reached out nationally then and tried to be encompassing in our program. So let's go on to the next question, Trent. If you can just pull the next polling pod on. We're still working with the technology here, if you figured this out. If you're having trouble with your audio or something, you can enter that in your chat box. What we have found in our past presentations is that the audio issues are usually having to do with bandwidth issues. And actually, unfortunately, most often out at the sight of the person that's having the trouble. So, but we've been able to work with some folks and help them do a better job. If you answer this question, even though it says marketing for your operation, we have had a number of producers involved. This question is primarily for them. So we'd like their feedback here on who's the person primarily responsible for their marketing. These polling questions will go very quickly. As soon as we bring them, you just bring your mouse over and click. Trent, can we go to the next question? And that's the one we just went through, I believe, Trent. As you can see, we'll get this down about the time we finish, but another question, who is the main person responsible? Owners, hired personnel, again, primarily for producers. For those of you that work with producers, and here's another question, how are you connected to today's seminar? It helps us to understand some of the technology issues. Even though the webinar technology is widely used, it's not seamless yet, and this is some important information for us to understand. The series in June, we had CEO from the Northwest Farm Credit Services, another banking executive out of California, several others from the banking sector. Really useful insights there. If you didn't watch those, I would encourage you to go back into our archives. I think some really good insights on helping you think. One of the things that really jumped out at me is that as we move forward here, the importance of liquidity, and virtually every one of our presenters talked about that. Give us a little information here about yourselves. What is your primary occupation? So I think we're ready now, and we're really pleased with our two presenters this morning. Very knowledgeable, good background. Matt Roberts is an associate professor in the Department of Agriculture, Environmental, and Development Economics at The Ohio State University. He's also an Extension State Specialist there. Prior to going back to grad school, Matt worked as a commodity and energy derivatives broker and also worked as a market research consultant with the pharmaceutical industry in North Carolina, and probably, although it's not our topic of the morning, can provide us some interesting insights about the whole healthcare discussion. And he's been at Ohio State University since 2001. Well, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you then for your slide presentation, and I'll be back to interact with you at the end of it with some questions from our audience. So, Matt, go ahead, kind of create the context in the grain area for us.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that introduction, John, and thank you to Duane for doing the technology here, and thank you to the Western RME Center for putting this on. I think this is a format of presentation that is really opened some great opportunities, and I'm excited to be here and take part. What I want to talk about today, obviously the title of the talk, is what are today's grain markets telling us about the future? So I want to talk obviously about grains, but I think before one can even really talk too much about grain markets, one has to talk a little bit about the petroleum market, about energies, and also about then we'll talk about petroleum to set up the grain markets. We'll talk about grains, starting with global supplies and the global outlook before moving to the U.S. We'll talk about biofuels, and I want to finish up talking about what I actually think in the long term may be one of the biggest issues facing the grain markets right now, and that is one of the biggest issues facing grain markets right now, and that is H.R. 2454, the Waxman-Markey, or this cap-and-trade bill. So I'm going to work through each of these. When we start, you know, the reason I start with the oil market is quite simple. Right now, the corn market is very influenced. I don't think this is a surprise to anybody, but the corn market is very influenced by ethanol market and by biofuels. And if you want to know what's going to happen to biofuels, you need to know what's going to happen to gasoline prices. If you want to understand gas prices, you got to start at petroleum. And so this is just a chart. On this chart, the I hope my cursor is showing up here. This green line at the top is Chinese economic growth from 1990 to present, year over year percentage change. The blue line is world economic growth, and the black line is the black line's world. The blue line is U.S. economic growth. The red line is red. The red line is oil use, change in oil use. And the reason I start with this is, although we hear so much about how much the increase in the third world, what impact that has had on overall economic or overall oil prices, when you look at this, although you can see some similarities between Chinese growth and the other growth, realistically, if you look at changes in oil use, that red line, it doesn't track as closely with that green line as it does with the black line. And really, that black line is the world economic growth. If you want to know what's going to happen to oil prices or to the consumption of oil, it's all about the world economy. It's not about China. It's not about India. It's not just about the U.S. It's about world economic growth. And what you see is up to 2004, 2005, they were very tightly coupled together. World economic growth and oil use were very tightly coupled together. Then, as basically economic growth from the world outstripped the oil market's ability to supply additional oil to the market, that's when we started to see that oil use drop off. And then eventually in 08, 09, we saw a real decline in world economic growth that actually, in a sense, almost caught up with that decline in world oil use. When we look at, this is a graph of world liquid fuel consumption. There's three different categories here. That darkest blue color you see is Chinese. Each year, how much liquid fuel does it use? What's the change in their liquid fuel? And what you see is, although yes, Chinese liquid fuel from 2002 to 2010, every year their total liquid fuel consumption increases. The darker green color there is the United States, and what you see is actually over the same time period, net, if we added this all up together, the U.S. consumption has actually declined from 2002 to 2010, while the rest of the world generally has grown. And so these are, again, you can't simplify this into, oh, this is because of China or because of India or because of the United States. There's a lot of things all going together in the overall oil market. Now, if you want to know where oil prices are, the single best statistic for oil prices, I'm sorry for the pauses. We keep popping back and forth here, the presenters do. The single best oil price, or kind of characteristic of what's going to set oil prices, is this graph right here. And what this graph shows is in OPEC, in the OPEC countries, how much more oil they could be producing than they currently are. Okay? And so as we go along from, you know, this starts in 98, from 98 to 2002, the OPEC countries could produce another 3 to 5 million barrels per day of oil. Now you see that gray line right there? That's 2.8 million barrels. That's considered kind of an important cut point. If we have more than 2.8 million barrels of extra capacity, basically it provides a lot of reassurance to the market. Now you can see starting in 03 through 08, the amount of extra pumping capacity that OPEC has, and the reason we only talk about OPEC is really the rest of the world is always producing at its maximum level. You don't hear about the United States suddenly deciding, prices are low, we're going to cut production. The rest of the world is pretty much producing as much oil as it can. It's OPEC that has that excess capacity and that actually uses that excess capacity. So 03 to 08, very tight markets. You go back to 04 and you see 04 and 05, maybe a million barrels per day. And this, to put in context, during this time period we were using about 80 to 82 million barrels a day. So maybe only an extra 1 to 1.4% capacity. So this would be, you know, the equivalent of having 40 million bushel carryout in corn or something along those lines. Very, very small carryouts is the equivalent of this. Now, as you can see, from 05 was the low point. 06, 07, 08, what's happening there is that rises, and especially in 9 and 10, is that we are seeing, we have seen some oil, especially in 08, 9, 10, come into production, some new fields, some new wells come into production, but obviously a lot of this is driven by global demand weakening down to meet that excess. But the key point here is with 9 and 10 having lots of excess production capacity, we should be a little more immune to the spikes and the vagaries of the oil market as prices change. Or as demand changes, it should buffer us from big changes in supply. So when we look at the futures markets, what we see is oil prices really from current out to about 2012 are right around $80 per barrel. Okay, from now to about 2012 are right about $80 per barrel. And the market seems very comfortable with that. Depending on what's going on, if one of these hurricanes does start to grow and move into the Gulf, you'll see these prices move up on the nearby. But as we look even farther out, the farthest out, the futures markets in oil trade out right now to December 2017, and the highest we see out there is about $94, $95. And so the market seems very comfortable in this range. It's a range that continues to disincentivize extreme amounts of usage, but yet it provides a high enough price to incentivize continued exploration and continued production. You know, and to realize why that's important, you may have seen last week British Petroleum announced that they found a new, very, very sizable oil reservoir in the Gulf of Mexico, very, very deep water. All told, I believe it's something on the order of 35,000 feet below the surface, a combination of water and rock that has to be drilled through. They need prices of $70 per barrel to make that profitable to bring that oil to the surface. So this price right here, a good balance to incentivize that continued exploration, very expensive exploration. At the same time, high enough, hopefully, to discourage a few of our sons and daughters from driving aimlessly around the square on Friday night. So that sets the oil stage. I think this $75, $85 per barrel is an area that the market's comfortable in the big picture. So now let's turn to global supplies. This is the global wheat market, and what you see here, there's basically two components of this graph that I want to highlight. I don't want the whiteboard. I want a pointer. Here we go. Let's try this. There's my little pointer. Okay. So at the top, this red line right here shows total global production. Okay, global production in million metric tons global of wheat. I'm sorry, of use, total use. The white line is total production, okay, is total global production. And then these red bars at the bottom, those are stocks use ratios. So in other words, at the end of each year, take the amount that's still in storage and divide it by total use. So we go back here to 2007, we had about a 20%, 19.4, 20% stocks use. We had total use that year of about 600 million metric tons, so that means we had about 120 million metric tons in storage at the end of the year. And what you see as you go back across this graph is, you know, 20% is extremely low. It was the lowest since the 40s, and that's what gave us, that's what set the stage for that big run-up in 2008. But since then, look what happened to production. That year we produced right at about 600 million metric tons. Our total use was actually about 612 million metric tons. Then production, global production went from 600 to 680 million metric tons from one year to the next, about a 13% increase. Now it's declined down to about 656 this year, but still very large production. Use has only increased much more slowly, and that's allowed these global wheat inventories to increase up to 26.2, up to 28.4%. And the reason this matters is wheat is a good single summary statistic of the global feed grain market. Wheat is a primary feed grain around the world, and it's a good indicator that feed grain supplies are returning to much more normal levels. When we go to soybean inventories, the same graph, I'm going to use this graph a number of times today, we see that production, although we had a couple years in 07, 08 when production did not keep up with use, this year production's expected to far outstrip use. Now this is contingent upon relatively large production occurring in South America this spring. Obviously, that is always a question mark. It's an interesting, I remember I started at OSU 8 years ago in 2001, and it seemed for the first 4 or 5 years that I was here every year when we talked about South America. We asked the question, geez, when will South America actually have a short crop? The last few years, it's really seemed like the opposite. Every year there's been a significant production shortfall for the last couple years, and so this year we're expecting that they'll have normal production, and if that's the case, it will be globally a record production year for soybeans. Oops, sorry, went ahead too. So now, when we talk about ethanol, and there's basically, I want to move more precisely into corn, I want to start with biofuels and with ethanol. And what this chart is, it's a comparison of gasoline and ethanol prices. And when that blue line is high, when it's above the black line, that's when gasoline's cheaper than ethanol. So you can go back here, and at this peak right here, this is when gasoline cost about $1.50 less than ethanol. That's when MTBE was being phased out. There was a real shortage of ethanol temporarily right there during the spring and summer of 2006. We look at the summer of 2008 when gas prices, when we were up to $4 per gallon, and suddenly ethanol was $1 per gallon less than gasoline. Now, none of this includes the blender's tax credit. You include those, instead of being $1 less, it's $1.50 less here. Instead of being $1.50 more, it's actually only 50 cents more. So just to put that in into perspective. But what we see now is ethanol is now once again cheaper than gasoline. And this is important because ethanol does deliver fewer miles to the gallon in cars, about, depending on the vehicle itself, 20 to 25% or 20 to 30% fewer miles to the gallon running E85 than gasoline. Now, this is important because consumers really honestly don't care about mileage. Or miles per gallon. They don't care that E85 gets fewer miles to the gallon. What they care about is miles per dollar. And so since ethanol, E85, delivers fewer miles per gallon, it needs to be sold at a discount for widespread penetration, even with the number of E85 vehicles that are out there. Very typical price differential, for example, right now, the gasoline station that's about a mile from my house here in Columbus, Ohio, has gasoline selling for about $2.50 and has E85 selling for about $2.30. That's simply not a big enough differential to justify the lower miles per gallon, the lower fuel mileage that you get. Now, as ethanol becomes cheaper and cheaper than gasoline, that differential should widen. Those of you, especially in the upper Midwest, you're going to have much wider differentials because you have much larger domestic capacity to produce ethanol and smaller capacity. We are an ethanol importing state. The Dakotas, Iowa, Minnesota are ethanol exporting states. So right now, overall, ethanol prices are about $1.55 to $1.60. Roughly, this is Chicago futures prices. They aren't a great indicator, but they give you a good idea as to where those prices are. So we take $1.60 ethanol. This green line right now is ethanol. If it's $1.60, these yellow lines give corn prices that correspond to it. At $1.60 ethanol, then corn prices that are $2.10 or below mean basically not building an ethanol plant becomes profitable to actually buy it and build it. $2.10 cash prices. Clearly, we're not in that area. Likewise, at $1.60 ethanol, if gas prices or if corn prices are above about $3.75 cash, it starts becoming harder and harder to justify continued operation of an ethanol plant. Now, this chart right here, I'm going through it kind of quickly. This chart is based upon an average ethanol plant. It starts with a spreadsheet that was actually published at University of Minnesota by Doug Tiffany and some other guys there. It's an excellent spreadsheet. I've made a couple little changes to it. But the big thing in this is that this is an average plant. And you know what they say about averages? Averages are wrong for everybody. So you can't just look at this spreadsheet and say, oh, well, cash prices are this, all plants are losing money, all plants aren't. Plants that are older, have older technology, or smaller, you can shift these curves up, shift these curves down, the yellow curves down. It's harder for them to make money. Newer, larger plants with better logistics, you can shift these curves up. They can continue to buy corn for longer. But right now, we're in this in-between area where, depending upon the characteristics of the exact plant, they're going to continue generally to operate, but they're going to have, depending upon corn prices, it's going to be more challenging for them to actually make debt service payments, make those long-term payments. And so that's a intermediate issue. Right now, the latest data I've seen is that the United States is roughly 20% of our capacity is idle. In the United States, most of it tied up in bankruptcy. For example, in Ohio, we have 7 plants, 3 of which are not operating, 3 of which are tied up in bankruptcy right now. Those 3 plants represent roughly half of our capacity. And so the determination of when they come back online is simply how fast it moves through bankruptcy court. So when we look at that and convert this into bushels, right now ethanol consumption is moving up. We're expected to take about 4.2 billion bushels this year, continue to climb up to about 5.2 billion bushels 2 to 3 years from now. Okay, so another billion bushels of demand right now. Now, what's driving that? Well, this is the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. This is all the mandates from that act. And what you have to realize is there's not a single mandate. I think if all of us sat down and tried to come up with the definition of renewable fuels, we could all sit down. I think last I looked, there were about 55 people on this webinar. And probably pretty quickly, we could come up with a nice definition for it. When our 535 elected representatives in Washington, D.C. sat down to define biofuels, this is what they came up with. 7 categories. Conventional biofuel, advanced biofuel, cellulosic biofuel, advanced non-cellulosic biofuel, biodiesel, and my favorite, advanced non-cellulosic, non-biodiesel biofuel. Each of these has separate mandates. Some of them are subcategories of the others. But when we talk about corn, this is really what we're talking about, this conventional biofuel. Right now, for this year, we're at a 10.5 billion gallon mandate. For calendar 2010, it's 12 billion gallon mandate. Now, the key thing to realize is right now we have built around, I believe, 12.5 to 13 billion gallons of capacity, and we have what is both built and under construction, about 15.1 billion gallons of capacity, all of which should be online at the latest by 2011. So this is going to be an easy mandate to meet. The big question is going to be, at what price does it take to sell more and more of these gallons? And I'm going to come back to that in a moment in the next slide. My curiosity much more, these advanced biofuels and cellulosic, starting in 2010, we have a cellulosic mandate. Starting in 2009, we have a biodiesel mandate. And especially this cellulosic, this 100 million gallons of cellulosic, I tend to call cellulosic ethanol tooth fairy ethanol because there are more people, I believe, in America that claim to have seen the tooth fairy than claim to have seen cellulosic ethanol produced at commercial scale. There's a lot of places where it can be produced at lab scale or pilot scale, but getting up to commercial scale production at anything approaching a reasonable price point so far is, it's really a fairy tale. And when we go over here to biodiesel, although we have more than enough capacity, I believe we have 800 to 900 million gallons of capacity of biodiesel. Right now that's operating at about 30 to 40% of capacity because the economics of biodiesel are so horrible. Simply put, when you want to make biodiesel out of vegetable oils or fats, you're really competing against human consumption directly, as opposed to corn ethanol, where you're competing against animals. So very different model. The key issue here, as I said, gasoline's now cheap, making ethanol quite cheap, and the problem is that the way that the EPA, I'm not going to go through this, I'm going to try and keep on time, I think I'm already behind, the way the EPA calculates this basically in 2009, 10.2% of all gasoline has to be ethanol of total gallons sold. Well, legally, you can only put 10% or 85%, 0 to 10 or 85% ethanol into gasoline. You can't run 10.2% or can't blend that legally under current EPA regulations. So that means basically, unless that E10 cap gets relaxed, the U.S. government's going to effectively be mandating that more and more gallons of E85 are sold. As we talked about before, to sell more and more of those gallons of E85, it has to be sold at a lower and lower price. So that means that there's a real difficult situation right now for the ethanol industry to sell more and more E85 at a lower and lower price, which creates tighter and tighter margins. Okay, so the ethanol industry, as we go forward, it's going to consume more bushels. That total consumption should increase by 800 million to a billion bushels in the next 2 years. It's going to be difficult to see how that profitability is maintained, and I think we're going to continue to see some bankruptcies here and there in that industry. Corn exports, this is a bright spot right now, not as strong certainly as 2 years ago, but as wheat availability's tightened up somewhat, as feed grain, other feed grain has tightened up, even in spite of the fact we have weaker global demand, we're still seeing more exports in 2009-10 than we did last year, which is quite a surprise. We look at overall feed use. This red line right here, this is total number of bushels going to feed use in the United States, and what you see is it peaked out in 05 at 6.1 billion bushels, has since declined to about 5.3 this year. The key thing, though, to realize is DGS has been playing a bigger and bigger role in feeding, and so while it looks like there's been about a 12% decline in feeding, in reality, since then, we've actually increased a little bit. We have decreased net from the 7 billion effective bushels 2 years ago, down to 6.7, but we've not declined 13% over the last 5 years, like just looking at the corn number might indicate. So the overall corn situation right now, 12% stocks use. You look back, that is not a particularly tight number. That's not a scary number. This market gets nervous when those numbers go below 10%. We are above that. Production this year slated at 12.76 billion bushels, use at 12.88 billion bushels. The question is, what is this production actually going to be? Obviously, a lot of questions about where yields end up. Most private forecasters are now looking at something closer to 13 billion bushels. I think this year, the way the weather has been through the Corn Belt, I think we're looking at a record yield. I'm expecting 162 to 164, something in that area, nationwide corn. If that happens, you're going to see this production move up another 250, 300 million bushels, and then you're going to see this stocks use, this ending inventory rise as well. My worry, I can come up very easily with a scenario that gets us at harvest cash prices far in the interior, so we're talking northwest Iowa, into the Dakotas, maybe Minnesota. I could see $2, $2.25 cash prices at harvest. Not sustained prices, not season average prices, but I think there is potentially a lot of downside risk here. There's obviously a lot of talk about frost and what frost could do. Key thing I would ask is, when is the last time a frost event has caused major yield damage over a broad area? Not that recently. You may have frost events that may cost a few bushels in very restricted areas, but it really needs to stretch far down into Iowa and Nebraska in order to have any significant impact, I believe, on U.S. national production. I think the odds of that are quite low when we look at historical trends. So really, it's about as bad as it can get for corn prices. Nothing's going right. We've got higher acreage, each of the estimates that have come out, lots of carry-in, exports stronger than last year, but still not great. With this cool summer we've had, I think we're going to be swimming in corn. There's going to be some big piles of corns across the Corn Belt. This isn't region specific across the Corn Belt. Throw on top of that, oil prices relatively weak compared to a year ago, means it's taken a lot of the steam out of ethanol. That's weakened support for corn. And then just continuing uncertainty in that ethanol industry with 20% idle capacity, and yet another 30%, that capacity is going to expand by about 30% in the next 2 years. So really right now, a lot of things looking very negative for the U.S. corn industry. When we look at soybeans, domestic demand is steady, up slightly over this year. I think the real question is, as we go forward, and especially into next year, as very weak margins in the livestock industry, especially dairy, but really across the livestock industry, what's that going to do to meal demand? These guys are bleeding money. How much longer? And meal prices, although they've come down, certainly have not come down as quick as other commodity prices. Exports have really been the brightest spot across any commodity. We're on track right now for another record year of exports, 9-10. We'll see what happens with South American production in the spring, but clearly the world's insatiable demand for soybeans and high-quality soybeans has not appeared to slow down. Overall, when we look at soybean inventories, moderately tight. The 7% number, when we look historically, is on the tighter side. It's below average. Not tight enough to make the market crazy like the 4% in the old crop that had all the uncertainty last year, but still low enough that any sort of hint, if we do get frost this year, soybean markets are going to move much more to it, react much more than corn will. Overall, production higher than use. Can spare a few bushels before things get crazy. So I think we will see some continued weakness in soybeans as we move into new crop. I think old crop has provided a lot of that support. The gray line in back is all wheat inventories. This is just like the previous graph. I've just omitted production and use numbers. This gray line in back is all wheat. The red is soft red that we use we grow in the Eastern Corn Belt. There's all wheat inventories continuing to rise, more and more wheat becoming available in the U.S., driven to a large extent by increased soft red inventories. These are just these percentage inventories. A farmer here that grows a lot of soft red that I talk to a lot has begun calling, he's oftentimes refers to soft red as America's feed wheat, and that's really what's happened. It's picked up a lot of acres. The basis has really become very squirrely in this. Does that mean I need to stop for questions real quick? I didn't catch that. I just got that message. Sorry.
Keep going.
No, okay. You're fine. Keep going.
Okay, so when we look at wheat, wheat's becoming plentiful. The reality is right now, market-wide, I'll be honest, I don't see much reason to be bullish about these markets. I think the best thing that I can say is soybean exports have been strong, and nitrogen has come down an awful lot in the past 12 months, obviously. When we start talking about management, I'm going to leave it to the guys next week to talk about risk management, but I think that this is going to be a year, as you move through harvest, to start thinking to yourself, okay, I think, how would I, if I had 09, if I had 08, 09 to do over again, how would I have marketed in hindsight? Because I think we are shaping up for another year in which it will be very easy with average yields, very easy to lose money because we don't have that safety net directly below our cost of production that guarantees sort of break even. This is going to be a year in which one can easily again see prices falling from February to harvest. And so I think it's going to be a critical year in which we ask, gee, how do we respond? I think it's very easy to come up with a scenario. I'm not forecasting this, but come up with a scenario in 9-10 that we have average, or 10-11, that we have average corn prices of $2.50 to $2.60, average cash corn prices. I don't think, I would not be at all surprised by that. Again, that's lower than what I expect. I expect a 3 to 325, but lower than that's easy to come to. And if we get to those prices with the rents that are out there, with the land that is out there, and still, even as nitrogen and other fertilizers have come down, those are still prices. It's going to be very hard to justify growing crops. You know, that's going to push land, we would expect, into beans and into wheat. Those markets don't have the demand structure to absorb more acres either. So overall, I think this is going to be a year where guys need to think about what does profit mean, and really work on managing their risk, managing that profit risk. So really quickly, I'm just going to go through. I have a lot more slides here. If anybody's on this wants to ask some questions later or follow up with emails later. The cap and trade bill is something I think people need to understand, growers need to understand better than they do. There's a couple points I want you to take away, and then I'm going to skip a lot of the details. The first is the Environmental Protection Agency now has been given the authority under the Clean Air Act. They have the authority, and based upon last year's Supreme Court ruling, they now have the mandate to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so this climate change bill that's working its way through Congress, it is not, there's a lot of talk out in the country that, gee, if that's defeated, we're fine. If that bill is defeated, the EPA has the mandate to step in and unilaterally impose greenhouse gas regulation. Waxman-Markey, this greenhouse gas bill is an attempt to have these regulations made by legislators instead of regulators, instead of the EPA. Now, a farmer I was talking to last week came up and said, well, this just sort of sounds like we have the choice between handing the loaded gun to a four-year-old or a six-year-old. I said, well, you know, that's true. I think a better one is the four-year-old's handing it. We have the choice to either leave it with the four-year-old or take it away and hand it to the six-year-old. And that's literally what this is. So we need to remember when we talk about, when ag lobbies talk about defeating this bill, that doesn't mean this goes away. It means the EPA will do it unilaterally. The ag portion of this bill was very rushed. There was nothing regarding ag in the committee bill. It was all added on the floor. If this bill gets passed, you will see higher fuel prices, eventually higher fertilizer prices, higher electricity, probably going to be relatively small, on the order of 5 to 15%. Percent. However, this bill will create the opportunity for farmers to basically sell permits to industries to emit more carbon. It's going to be through no reduced tillage, biodigestion, cover crops. I think that for most crops, most row crops, this will more than offset, those offsets will more than offset the higher input costs. But it's going to be different. CAFOs, I think, are actually the big winners here. CAFOs that can put in anaerobic digesters have the potential, I think, to really do very well under this legislation. Other crops, cotton, rice especially, will do very poorly. They don't have as much opportunity to go to no-till or other carbon-reduced production practices, and they are fertilizer-intensive. So, I'll let you guys read that later. The slides are all up. The devil's in the details of all this bill. It can come out written very favorable to ag or very unfavorable. I think it will have to be favorable in order to pass, but there are some big questions here. Additionality, in other words, if you're already no-tilling, do you still get to sell credits? When we talk about no-till, we really are talking about not much till. The EPA, when they talk about no-till, they're talking about never-till. What's it going to take to get farmers to never-till? What's the complexity of this program going to look like? I mean, look at Acre sign-up. Acre was a no-brainer by the time sign-up closed, yet we still have relatively low sign-ups for it. So imagine trying to get farmers to sign up for a program like this. So with that, let's go to questions.
Okay, Matt, thank you. And for our team, we're going to ask, I got one question here for Matt at this point, and I'd like to bring the polling, a couple of polling questions up while we do that and transition over to Jim Robb's presentation. But Matt, A lot of information there, really powerful information. Do you, as you look at that, and you made some really good information about energy, do you see any, what are the possibilities for a decoupling of corn prices and energy prices at some point here in the future?
That's a great question. I don't see any reason that they should decouple. I think after that corn mandate tops out in another couple years, in other words, we get to 15 billion gallons of production, we will probably see the correlation weaken, so the coupling won't be quite as tight. But fundamentally, I would argue what is driving this is really the fact that there is fundamentally energy in corn. And when we had $2 corn and $20 per barrel oil, it wasn't worth extracting that energy from the corn. Now that we have $70 per barrel oil, which I think is kind of permanent, I think we're kind of in an era of higher oil prices. That's a talk unto itself. It is much easier to extract economically that energy from the corn. So now, clearly government policy has helped that. I still assert, even if we didn't have government policy, we would still have a sizable ethanol industry in this country.
And as we're, one last question, as we're going up to Jim Robb's presentation, what's your expectation about corn acres, and will they decline?
Another great question. Over time, I think that corn acres from where we are now will, you know, we'll continue to see a few million acre change year to year. I don't believe we will see a systematic decline in corn acres for the next 5 to 10 years. Now, what the uncertain parts there, obviously, you got a lot of guys talking about by 2015 we're going to have, you know, 180, 190 bushel national yields, and we've got drought resistant corn and all this sort of stuff. I'll wait and believe it when I see how it does in the fields. That clearly would free up some acres, but no, I don't fundamentally see a reason that for corn acres to significantly decline. I think it'll be year to year based upon relative prices and rotations.
Thank you very much. Hang around so that we'll have a chance to ask another question or two at the end. But we're going to transition now to Jim Robb, and we're really pleased that Jim has agreed to join us. He's an agricultural economist with the Livestock Marketing Information Center. And for those of us that use it, know what a marvelous resource this center is. And those of you that don't, I would really recommend you go out and find and look at the information they have there. It's one of the best sources of information around livestock markets. And Jim has been the director of the center since 1993. And he's had experience in Nebraska and UC, University of California, and Michigan State University systems. One last note about the Livestock Marketing Information Center. It began over 50 years ago. And the really neat thing about it, it's a cooperative effort. And there are 28 land-grant universities that support it, several USDA agency and associated organizations. And so Jim is going to give us a briefing here about livestock markets. The floor is yours, and thank you very much.
thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. My slide presentations are sometimes known as movies. We'll go through these very quickly. The opportunity for you to revisit the slides at your own pace and for your own areas of interest is one of the real powerful things of these webinar types of efforts. So really, don't try to focus on individual aspects within the graphs. We're trying to paint a picture here. So a little bit fast and furious is the nature here. So let's go in that mode here. We want to talk about sort of the background of the livestock markets, focusing on where we're at and the recession. And I was asked to give a little bit more detail on the hog markets, the dairy markets, the cattle markets, and then kind of managing in this environment. We will end with our price forecasts. Those are not USDA's price forecasts. Those are from the LMIC, which is this cooperative effort. All the data sources are from USDA, National Ag Statistics Service, Ag Marketing Service, Foreign Ag Service, Economic Research Service. So these are very important data sources that really do provide the foundation to our ability to understand what's going on in this very dynamic market environment. So with that, aggressive agenda, let's move forward and talk about the big picture and try to paint that a little bit. Matt Roberts has well described the linkages, the importance of the grain sector to the livestock sector. Obviously, for cattle, corn has been a major factor. Our cost of gain in feed yards is very high compared to where it was a few years ago. Soybeans certainly impact the hog and dairy and poultry industry much more than the cattle sector, at least on balance. As we go through these slides, the dotted lines will be last year, the blue line, the solid line will be this year, and the red line will be the prior five-year average. The point here is that these costs of gain are much higher. That does impact feeder animal prices significantly. We have, for example, calf prices well below a year ago due to the corn market. And our assessment of prices is very similar in what's embedded in our forecast to what Dr. Roberts talked about. Obviously, these corn prices have been very volatile. A year ago at this time, we had just passed through Omaha corn prices approaching $7.50 a bushel, still above a year ago, and that volatility has been a driver in the livestock sector. From a very broad perspective, a species that I'm not going to cover here but are part of my background, the broiler sector has been hit hard by these higher feedstuff costs. The broiler industry has just turned profitable in the last quarter and has lost a lot of money. So, for example, we see the number of egg sets, those are the fertilized eggs that will be hatched and grown into chickens, have been running well below a year ago in the prior five-year average. This is sort of important from the big picture perspective. Again, they are adapting to record high feedstuff costs. But the poultry industry has not posted a year-to-year decline in the United States. In other words, production has not declined from one year to the next. And it's going to do that this year. The last time that happened was 1973. So these are really unprecedented times and how the industries have reacted. And the broiler industry is very dependent on exports. If we look way over here on this part of the chart, we see that about nearly 20% of U.S. broiler production is exported. These export markets have become very important and have added really to the volatility in some sense, the upside and the downside in these markets much more than we have seen historically. Just to give a little bit more perspective on that big picture, this is the hog industry, and you have to be careful when economists do their graphs. We hide things in the subtitles that say things like percentage of production. We always change the axis to make it confusing. But here's the year-to-year decline between this year and last year in terms of the percentage of pork being exported. We were up at 20% of U.S. pork being exported last year. Significant decline driven by the H1N1 situation. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to the pork complex. So important adjustments have happened domestically and internationally. Just to give a quick preview of the same types of numbers on the beef side, this is the percentage of production that's exported in beef. These numbers are pre-BSE over here, and then we decline dramatically. We have built back up. This year we see a modest decline in our forecast in exports, and really really some modest growth as we look ahead, and that's the scenario that we're working with at this point in time. So we've made great progress since the BSE era, but we actually still have a ways to go. And there are constraints to how much we can export. That has a lot to do with domestic production. So in wrapping up kind of the part of the big picture, from the production side, the supply side, and the total red meat and poultry complex, these commodities at the consumer level, certainly the chicken and the pork are competing with beef items, and there's a lot of interaction, maybe more so than there was 20 years ago. We're actually going to see some year-to-year declines, and this is this year. In terms of the total red meat and poultry production in the United States in 2009 will be below a year ago and stay rather flat as we look ahead. We're not going to get this rather clear ramping up that we've seen in recent years, again, due to the economic situation of producers, largely driven by costs of production. If we look at the overall U.S. economy, which is very important to the meat complex, this is a quarterly change. This is the last recession in the United States. This is the current period that we're in. We think that we're out of the recession today. This last number is the second quarter of this year. And really, as we come out of recession, consumers still feel pretty bad. The data this morning on consumer credit clearly shows that consumers are still feeling very, very cash poor. They're currently saving lots of money and not really spending it. So it'll be quite a while. This is economists, we talk about various shapes of recovery. This is a long, slow recovery process from a situation that is the worst recession since the Great Depression, and that has impacted consumers. You can come back to this chart should you want to see it. Just one thing to build on what Dr. Roberts said, when we've had these past oil-embedded shocks, maybe this is different, this is only two data points in time, but those recessions have lasted much longer, like this recession has, compared to most normal ones. And so this is a market that has had to adapt to that. So what does that mean sort of in the context of, for example, the beef complex? Well, as economists, we do measures of demand. The data are not very good, but as we try to sift through what is available, we come up with indexes on the meat side of demand. Demand is a relationship that includes both per capita consumption and the price that consumers are willing to pay. This is the second quarter of this year in these estimates. And on this scale here, that number for the second quarter of this year is like 75. Well down from the Atkins diet era in terms of consumer demand, still above where we were a few years ago. In this kind of economic environment, to have consumer demand for beef falter, especially with huge amounts of pork, much of this quarter-to-quarter faltering has been largely driven by the spillover impacts on beef demand coming out of the pork complex. But certainly we can see the impacts of the recession and what's going on in the competing meats impacting negatively the demand at the consumer level for beef. And certainly this has to be reflected back into cattle prices, for example. So that's really the environment that we're working in. But more importantly, especially, and this is an example from the beef sector again, now the next two slides, just focus on the red line and the blue line. The blue line's this year, the red line's last year. This is the tenderloin price at the wholesale level. And this really reflects what's going on in the restaurant industry in the United States. The restaurant industry is still contracting in the United States. Same-store sales reported for a month ago are still declining compared to a year ago in the United States red restaurant industry. And we can see that the tenderloin prices, which is really driven by the white tablecloth industry, this is the highest value beef cut, are really well below a year ago. And if we look, for example, at like the chuck prices, which are very much sold in grocery stores, consumers have actually traded away from buying in restaurants in the meat complex to buying in grocery stores. This has hit the beef complex probably harder than the other species because beef is very much a center-of-the-plate restaurant item. And so we can see that as consumers have traded down in a sense, they've traded away from restaurants, and they traded towards buying their products in grocery stores, probably a trend that has some rather long-term implications in terms of buying patterns as we look ahead. Now, this is a bit of a digression, but I think really important aspect here in these meat markets. If we look at what happened this last year in terms of prices last fall, and this is the steer, hide, and offal value on a live steer per hundredweight basis, and here's the international credit crisis emerging. In a matter of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks, we took $6 per hundredweight out of live steer prices, fed cattle, calves, and yearlings, due to the international credit crisis. This is the value of the hide, the offal, the internal organs, and all these items are essentially completely dependent on export markets, Asian markets, European markets, Russian markets, etc. And it really wasn't, you know, the meltdown financially that spilt over into the, at least the cattle complex, was heavily driven not by the meat market last fall, but by this $6 per hundredweight decline in the value of the non-meat items in the beef complex. Recently, we've had some ramping back up. China has come back. This is an international economic situation, and we're seeing China, Korea, etc., starting to ramp back up. Our supplies are down, but we're still running fully $2 to $3 per hundredweight below a year ago in terms of our cattle markets due to these non-meat items. So it's been a very broad-based, and it has had a clear international tie to how prices have behaved lately. So that's sort of the background. That's very quick. Again, you can go back and look at things. I was asked to talk briefly about the hog sector. This picture up in this corner here is taken in the central square in Mexico City in the midst of the H1N1 situation down there. So let's talk a little bit about more detail about the pork complex. Again, all these complexes are interrelated. Not one for one, but certainly what goes on in the pork sector and the chicken sector compete against each other, and certainly those do interact, especially with some of our beef components. Hog prices, this is when the H1N1 situation hit. We've had very dismal hog returns. We had a collapse this summer. We've come back slightly. We've lost a lot of money in the U.S. hog complex. This is essentially now to the levels of unprecedented losses for U.S. hog producers. Certainly well below a year ago on prices, and was still rather high costs of production. And certainly a year ago, even though we had cattle or hog prices much higher than today, the high feedstuff costs essentially caused producers still to lose money at those prices. If we look at market hogs available to the marketplace, we can see that that's declined in the latest numbers, but still the number of market hogs is the second largest ever. The U.S. industry is still very productive. We get lots of pigs per litter. That's a growing number. We really haven't made much of a cutback, and we're starting from a record high base in terms of number of market hogs as we head into this adjustment process that's happening in the U.S. hog sector. Finally, the last 2 weeks, we've seen sow slaughter finally pick up above a year ago levels. A year ago, we were getting some sow herd liquidation, but look what happened earlier this year. Earlier this year, losing money, the U.S. hog industry was fundamentally not adjusting the supply of the number of breeding animals available. So we're just beginning, largely, the adjustment process in the U.S. hog industry. Feeder pig imports from Canada are well down from where they were. This clearly reflects the declining size of the Canadian hog industry, which has been a key supplier of pigs to the U.S. market. So we're having many interactions going on here. Now, with more pigs per litter, even with our forecast that the number of sows in the United States will decline, these are the quarterly forecasts. The brown bars are from the LMIC in 2011. But I think the point is, even as we decline the number of sows, we're expecting that pork production in the United States is not going to decline very much over the next few years. The productivity in this industry, we're going to need to liquidate enough sows to not only keep production steady, but try to get some type of reduction in total production to get prices to where they are profitable again for the industry. Certainly lower corn prices will help, but certainly in recent times, the higher soybean meal prices have not been very helpful to this industry. Now, in terms of what's happened lately after H1N1, we can see that our pork exports have declined, and really we lost export markets. And from an economist's point of view, the key is that in the second quarter of this year, pork production was down about 2% from a year ago. But given that we export so much pork, we put in front of domestic consumers about 3.3% more pork in the marketplace. So the U.S. pork industry has really suffered, largely due to the international economic conditions, especially after the international credit crisis. a huge change in exchange rates overnight, and H1N1. Okay, so that's the brief aspect of the hog sector. Now we're going to switch very quickly, take a big breath, and talk quickly about the dairy sector. Dairy sector is interacting here. Let's see where we're at there in a very real quick sense. Dairy cow numbers in the United States were up in the first quarter of this year. They're starting to decline. But look at these numbers compared to the prior five-year average. We have grown the U.S. dairy cows. We're just starting to see some of the declines. Dairy cow slaughter has started to pick up on the weekly data. We've had one dairy cow buyout program. We're in the midst of another one. We expect that we'll have another one in the fourth quarter of this year that will have impacts on not only cull cow prices, but also probably on hog prices and other components, and we can talk about that more. But certainly that's been a component here where these sectors are very linked together, and what has to happen in the dairy cow sector or dairy sector with liquidation of cows is spilling over into our other markets. Milk production per cow was down in the first quarter of this year. BST has pulled back high grain prices. But if we look at the second quarter of this year, we've already turned the corner towards more milk production per cow, really back on the long-term trends. So that's a fundamental nature of the U.S. industry, but that has to be compensated for also in terms of declining dairy cow numbers. Now, one thing that changed dramatically here in recent years in the U.S. dairy sector has been that we became an export dairy industry, or at least in parts supported by the export markets. Dramatic growth in recent years in the dollar value of dairy product exports from the United States. We used to worry mostly in this all these years that we imported lots more dairy products than we exported. We became a net exporter of dairy products in the matter of just a couple of years. Very supportive of markets. And then what happened earlier this year, the international credit crisis, the ramping down of demand worldwide, and now we see, for example, in this market that exports are essentially half of what they were a year ago. So we've lost an export market. We had increasing number of cows, increasing production, and we also have a weak demand both in the export and domestic markets. Perfect recipe for lower prices and disaster in the dairy industry. That's exactly what happened. At this time last year, we were talking $20 milk prices. Now we're talking $11 Class 3 milk prices due to this coming together of those events. We can see that cheese prices, for example, which are, you know, fully cheese prices compared to last summer are down by $1 per pound, or cut in half compared to where they were this summer compared to last summer. That is clearly spilt over into milk prices. Butter prices, as the international market collapsed last year, butter prices collapsed, pulling down, and we can see that our butter prices are well down. So the economics of this industry have clearly come together, and we're in the midst now of a liquidation phase. Okay, take one more breath, and we only have one more major species to go through, and that's the cattle sector. Fed cattle prices, the blue line, are clearly below a year ago. We had record high prices last summer, a very unusual event. Only about 1 year out of every 25 do Fed cattle prices peak out in the summertime. Likely this year they will peak out in the fourth quarter, but it's a struggling market. It's a market that's being held back largely by the pork complex and consumer demand, both domestic and foreign, and also demand for these byproducts. Still, the demand for hides to go on car seats, leather goods, demand for internal organs, which are mostly sold overseas, demand for tallows and greases that people cook with in other countries are all off, and that's a whole other demand component that is much weaker than a year ago that the market is struggling with in terms of cattle prices. In terms of 7 to 8 weight steer prices, these are the Southern Plains. This year we're well below last year. Probably the peaking has happened here. Here's the international collapse that happened last year, and we can see how that directly fed back into cattle prices. One thing as we look ahead down the road, the transition of higher feedstuff costs, etc., is causing more and more animals to be held to these heavier weights before they enter feed yards. So as we look ahead over the next several years, probably this seasonal peak gets pulled back earlier, maybe more so like this year as we look ahead, and we're just going to have a lot more cattle coming to market at these weights in this time frame than we probably have seen historically. In terms of calf prices, 5 to 6 weight steer calves in the southern plains, those prices are depressed. But as we think as we get into the fourth quarter, those prices will be above a year ago. And some of the worst news is probably behind the market. As Dr. Roberts talked about, corn prices are probably headed for lower rather than higher. Certainly we have wheat pasture conditions that look like some of the best potential in maybe 20 years. Some of the demand for these calves could actually finally strengthen a little bit late in the fourth quarter compared to the pattern of recent years. But certainly a very volatile market. And one that even this year has been highly volatile, and that may be more of the nature to come. This one I'm going to slow down just a little bit on. I know that's hard for some of you to believe, but let's slow down just a little bit and focus on the very difficult to see here green line, which is weekly whole muscle beef cuts to South Korea. And here is when we really started to ramp up. The Koreans started to take our product, and in a matter of 3 to 4 weeks, we were fully back to the levels that we had pre-BSE. Then, almost right on cue, the international credit crisis and financial crunch hits, and our exports weekly drop. And in 3 to 4 weeks, we've cut those exports dramatically. Our exports to Mexico went from this level to this level in a matter of 2 weeks. Exports to other countries also declined. So we can see some of the reasons why cattle prices declined last fall. And the recovery here has really been one of stabilization rather than a lot of recovery in our export markets. So our beef exports, as we forecast ahead, which will be a component, we see them down this year, up a little bit the next couple years, but really the supply in the domestic sense constraining those to grow back to where they were. Our imports are down from where they were a few years ago. Imports this year are up, most of that product coming from Australia, most of that product going into the manufactured beef items due to exchange rates and the drought in Australia. But again, as we look ahead, those numbers we don't see getting back to where they were just a few years ago. So in terms of domestic supply that the consumer sees, either through manufactured products like hot dogs, et cetera, or whatever, isn't going to grow a lot from these levels. This slide here is too busy for you to really want to look at in any great detail, but it's to make a point. The point is that the Canadian cow herd is declining. The Mexican cow herd is declining. The South American three key country cow herd, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay is declining. The Australian cow herd is declining. The European cow herd is declining. It's a worldwide phenomena of tightening cattle numbers is what we're in the midst of. And this has largely been driven by economic conditions and feed grain costs. Now, in terms of the U.S., we have to talk about where we are in the U.S. cyclical aspects. The bars here on this next slide are the U.S., our estimates at the LMIC, Southern Plains, returns over cash costs plus pasture rent. Very good a few years ago. This last year, 2008, was the first time in 10 years that we had many cow-calf producers in the United States did not cover their cash costs of production. What happens in that situation? We tend to try to sell enough animals to meet our cash obligations, whether that be extra cows or extra heifers. Another thing to note from this slide is that the cattle inventory in the U.S. goes up and down, but it doesn't go up and down like it used to. The cattle inventory is still an aspect of the industry, but certainly not the dominant influence that maybe it was in the last couple cattle cycles, and certainly nothing like cattle cycles of the 1980s and 1990s. Certainly those animals carry a lot of weight when we translate those cows into calves into beef production. We do that at very high carcass weight, so a few head of cows can make a big difference in tonnage in the marketplace, but it's not the old days. We don't want to assume in the industries that old-time cycle logic in terms of management will do us very good stead as we look ahead. And this year we're looking for, our preliminary estimates are essentially break even in cow-calf country. The calf crop in the United States is shrinking. That was a pretty fast slide. The next slide here is really important. The number of heifers held as beef cow replacements is reported by producers to USDA's National Ag Statistics Service shows that down 2.2% from a year ago. The number of heifers at this level does not provide any fundamental potential for growth in the U.S. beef cow herd. So the U.S. beef cow herd really can't grow until probably sometime after 2011, maybe after 2012. So we're really looking at tightening numbers ahead in the United States in terms of our overall breeding stock is already built into the system. How does that translate into beef production? As we make more and more animals enter feed yards at yearling weights, we're going to see production pretty flat in first quarters, big year-to-year declines in the second quarter, flat in the third. So we're making a transition into the industry of when beef will tend to be produced. And if I had to bet as an economist, the peaks in cattle prices on a fed cattle basis will be in the second and fourth quarters of the year. Returns to cattle feeders are still negative. One reason lower corn prices have not yet translated into higher calf and yearling prices is that feedlots are just starting to get to break even after a record long series of losing money. Corn prices will usually help calf prices, but not in an environment where you're losing record amount of money in the cattle feeding sector. So overall, we expect cattle prices to increase over the next few years on fed cattle, on 7 to 8 weight steers, on calves, not back to record levels. Depends on corn prices. To make record levels, we're going to need to see much cheaper corn than we have recently. But fed cattle prices by 2011 should be reapproaching record high levels. In terms of managing in these times, we need to understand that we're in a demand problem. It's going to be a slow recovery. We think volatility continues in these livestock marketplaces. This is a specific example for cattle, but it applies to most species. Volatility and shocks will continue. We had a shock in the livestock markets after 9/11. We had a shock in the cattle market after BSE. We had a shock in the cattle market after the credit crisis. Those shocks, we've already had 3 this decade. I suspect that shocks will also continue. Grain prices will continue to be a key driver, especially of what feeder animal prices will be and the profitability of our livestock sector. In terms of cattle producers, we need to think in terms of moving away from the long-term logic of managing by cattle cycles and managing and not necessarily changing our operation, but be willing to understand and deal with these shorter-term phenomena as the drivers in terms of prices rather than long-term cyclical aspects. We think it's important for producers to increasingly know how their cattle will perform in the next stage of production. If you don't know how your cattle perform for the people that buy them, it's going to be increasingly difficult in a volatile and shock-driven marketplace to be able to sell those at the higher end of the price range. Near-term calf and yearling prices will follow fed cattle prices. Fed cattle prices will need to get stronger to pull those higher. We think as we look ahead, managing cull cows for profit will be increasingly important. Again, we expect another dairy herd buyout yet this fall. That could put pressure into that market. But as we look long-term ahead, cull cows a year from now will probably be much more valuable than they are today. And we think it's also important for producers right now to be planning for higher prices and higher costs of production in 2010 and 2011. The next 3 slides are you can look at it at your leisure. They are our forecasts of quarterly hog prices. Our quarterly forecasts from a fundamental perspective are a little bit lower than the futures are today. On dairy prices, a similar story. Our prices are a little bit lower than the futures are today, largely because the industry has not cut back on milk per cow, etc., and we really haven't cut very many dairy cows out of the system as we have a large number of heifers behind these cows that are being liquidated. In terms of cattle prices, though, our price forecasts are slightly higher than what the futures market are suggesting. Please take those price forecasts with a grain of salt. Those are clearly trying to get a fundamental understanding of what's going on in the marketplace and need not actually reflect what prices will be. A year ago at this time, we talked in terms of the dairy segment, hog segment, and cattle segment, that the futures markets look consistently too high, but we didn't realize how too high they were. So with that, thank you very much, and I know that was fast, but at your leisure, please feel free to go back and page through those at a more appropriate pace.
Jim, thank you for presenting a lot of information in a very understandable way. We do have a question from one of our audience members, which we're asking you to shift a little out of the forecasting, looking ahead business, which you've done really well. But this individual asks, what risk management strategies would you recommend for cow-calf producers for the next 2 years?
Well, I think largely from cow-calf producers, it's back to the basics. It's back to understanding that costs of production are important. I think it's back to understanding that in many areas of the U.S., we need to have a buffer in terms of our forage supplies. We need to understand that market risks are going to be there. And so we need to think in terms of when am I going to sell the animals. If we do, for example, see corn prices a year from now skyrocket again on a short corn crop, then we need to understand how prices have behaved historically and how we manage for that. I think there are some tools out there for the cow-calf sector in the LRP products from the Risk Management Agency and crop insurance that are pretty good tools for some livestock operations that really don't require some of the intensity of marketing that we have, for example, in the futures market. But I think it's very much in cow-calf country back to the basics. It's back to managing, looking at my breeding programs, trying to get very productive animals into my herd. I think that's the fundamentals, especially in cow-calf country, as we look ahead. You know, sharp pencil, back to the basics, is really a key part of our risk management at that production level. Feedlots, hog operations, dairies, I think there certainly are some other things to look at in if we transition to those.
You did mention briefly some about what dairy liquidations, the impact they might have in the other livestock market sectors. Can you elaborate just a little on that? And what is it going to have more meaning? What do you see coming out of the dairy liquidations?
Well, we do expect another round of a CWT industry-led dairy cow liquidation program, probably yet announced this year. So certainly that does provide some potential additional pressure to cull beef cow prices in the fourth quarter, which is when they tend to be lowest. That's when we cull most of our beef cows. But there is clearly spillover across the front, and we talk about other species. As we have increased cow beef production, the type of beef that comes from cull cows, that very much competes in the pork complex, especially in the sausage markets and the manufactured meat markets. And so a lot of the blending in the industry has really been disrupted by these very low pork prices and then beef prices going up and down. All the people that make sausages and hot dogs and Lunchables and all these manufactured food items really are using largely products that come from sows and cows and the lower value parts of the chicken. And so there is a lot of interaction here that will spill over out of this dairy cow slaughter, not only just directly to the cull cow market, which will be under pressure and is certainly something to watch for, but we see some negative spillover that's happened in the pork and poultry complex also due to the necessary dairy cow liquidation. We have to liquidate enough dairy cows probably on a year-to-year basis. By January of this year, we need to see about 300,000 head less dairy cows than a year ago to even have a chance to bring milk prices up to break even for most U.S. dairy operations. And break even is not making money. That's just the beginning. So we still have a ways to go in necessary dairy cow liquidation and the potential spillovers.
Matt, would you turn your mic back on? I have another question here for you, and it has to do with market volatility and increasing uncertainty. And what do you think that implies for the timing of grain marketing? What are some of the basic risk management advice you would give to grain producers in these volatile markets?
Well, I think the first is because there is less certainty of a profit, and because I believe we are going to see in general more acreage shifts back and forth, we need to think kind of about the role of the spring prices, the pre-planting prices. Those are prices that are there to in a sense, auction acres among the different crops. They are there to, in years in which corn looks like it may be kind of tight, to try and bid more acres into corn, or when corn looks, or when soybeans look sort of tight, bid acres into beans. once those acres are planted, so once we hit sort of May, June, May in most years, June in this year, there's really not much reason for the market to continue to push those prices higher. And so what I really encourage farmers to do is, or what you, I believe farmers are going to have to do, think much more carefully about revenue insurance and what that guarantees them. And any revenue that doesn't bring in other words, if you get only your minimum guarantee from your revenue insurance, say $500 an acre, if that doesn't give you sufficient, then I think taking advantage of January, February, March prices to go ahead and market some of that production then to get that entire, in a sense, minimum guarantee, guaranteed level of revenue up to a sufficient level is going to have to play a bigger role. I mean, in the past, we always knew what the minimum revenue was. It was basically bounded from below by LDPs and other things. That's not the case any longer. So I think much more pre-plant marketing is going to have to play a bigger role, as well as thinking of revenue insurance as a marketing tool.
Thank you. And one last question for Jim. How do you see hog markets changing with adjustments in the feedstock and the increasing volatility with consumer demand?
Well, I think the hog markets are, we're in a transitional time. We really don't see producers making money in the hog complex until the spring of 2010. So we got a lot of transition still ahead of us. After we make that transition in terms of feedstuff costs, et cetera, I think the volatility, and the industry is going to still be very dependent on export markets. And so I think it's one of an industry that has structurally changed in the last 20 years dramatically, an industry that is, going to, like recently, you go through a period of lack of profitability, and because of the size of operations and the structure of the industry, we don't adapt very quickly. But when they do adapt, it can happen with a large operation going out of business or downsizing abruptly. So I think it's going to be a changed environment. I think we'll see hog operations much more using forward pricing techniques. We already price most of our hogs on some kind of formula basis, etc. I think a lot of those trends will continue, and we'll have to have a couple years at least of just trying to heal the wounds that we've had inflicted on the industry in the last 15 or 16 months.
Thank you very much, both Matt and Rob. We've run out of time. Really information-packed presentations. For those of you out there, as these presentations are up on our Ag at Uncertain Times webpage, the URL, the web address over there on the left, and I would need to move quickly to conclude here. We've got three more weeks of additional webinars on the operating space of uncertain markets. More about a great lineup around family space uncertainty and agriculture. Great information later in November. Operating in a risk environment. So, again, you can either Google farmmanagement.org or AgriVaxer at a time, get to our webpage. We have the recording for the webinar there. The whole presentation material is licensed. Hey, there. To look at list of speakers and content information and discussion of the webinar topics. If you, what area of today's seminar would you like to see covered in next week's marketing strategy? We have two really good presenters talking about marketing strategies that Essent has many years of experience in industry on both sides of the market equation. In the grain marketing industry, and Dylan Foitz from Utah State University, who has got an excellent grasp on livestock markets, will be going into some more detail on those strategies. But if you some things you'd like them to think about and consider, either send us an email at westrme@wsuedu or send it over here on the chat pod to the left. We've already been through our polling questions. And I don't know, do we have any, we do have, you can click on this file, which has all of the information about websites and that you go to find this information, and then you see in the bottom part of that pod it says save to my computer. You, I believe, and Dwayne, you can step in if I'm not going through this correctly. You click on that and follow the directions there, and you can download that right off onto your own computer, so you have all of these web addresses there. Join us next week, next Wednesday, again, same time of the day, 9 a.m. Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, 12 Eastern, for a couple of excellent presentations where they go more into depth on marketing strategies given these markets that we find ourselves in. The day after that, on Thursday, some excellent presentations around direct markets, niche marketing, specialty crops. So thank you all for joining us. I've done a little Outlook work in myself, and I'll have to say that both of these presentations had really good, useful, insightful information that we can use to kind of create the context thinking forward. I was hoping they'd all both come in with this really rosy picture, but the one thing we have learned in the past about when things aren't going as well as they ought to, probably the single most important thing for agriculture producers, is to look that reality straight in the face and create strategies that are based on those realities. So thank you to Matt and Rob again, and thank you all for being with us. We'll see you next week at the same time.